Morning all. And as Zach and Cheryl have reminded us so beautifully and enthusiastically, it's a beautiful morning, absolutely beautiful. And yesterday was gorgeous. And we like the story that that Tim Penner related, we were kind of keeping an eye on the excuse me, keeping an eye on the restrictions opening up, and have just been aching to you know, to have people here in our yard in this season, as you know, that's what we're permitted, but you know, which also sort of feels like connecting to home, so having them at our home if not in it. And and we were able to have some dear friends over for a distance conversation in the yard yesterday. And between the weather and the friends and the meaningful connections all around, and sort of watching our adult kids, you know, working at making those same kinds of arrangements here, and bit of a ramble, I realize. Don't worry, I'll get to the cogent note-based part directly, but man, did that ever feel good. And I don't even really have good words for how that felt, how important it felt to be able to do some of those things that we wouldn't have thought twice about a year and a half ago, you know, which I think is an important sort of lesson in itself. I heard a brief interview with I'll forget his name now because I don't follow the sport, but a Canadian Olympic bobsled medalist, a young guy, 31-year-old athlete who just about died of COVID last year, talking about his experience of how tomorrow is not promised. True. But not a thing we always carry around in the front of our minds, right? And there are ways in which the circumstances that we have been through and are going through continue to work our way through personally, collectively, globally, in this moment of history, a profound reminder that tomorrow is not promised, which I think in a culture that gives so much energy to blunting the big questions sometimes, saying something like tomorrow is not promised can feel like, oh man, thanks for being a bummer, Tim. Zach and Cheryl, we're up and happy and cheery, and here you go with tomorrow's not promised. And it can have that vibe, but it doesn't need to. Tomorrow's not promised can also be just a deep, substantial reminder that this is the moment we have. So joy, hope, celebration, engagement, pick a positive word and way of being and be it in this moment. We have this one. And so we can sit here and lament the fact that the next one isn't promised, or we can be here as fully as possible. And that's the choice I think is the better one, and certainly the one that I want to keep leaning into. Let's take a moment to acknowledge that when we gather, when we go about our everyday lives, as our lives open up in this season, all of these things happen on this part of the continent, which is, among other things, Treaty 1 land. And acknowledging that is a way of centering an important moment in itself. It's a way of reminding ourselves that this project of telling the truth about our own history, and by our, I mean human history, on this part of the continent, in this part of the planet, is important. And we need to keep doing that. And some of that truth will be hard to bear, hard to face. And some of it will take us to places that are so so utterly beautiful that it just about stops us dead. So, here we are on Treaty 1 land, grateful to be, grateful to gather, grateful for our kin who were here long before those of us with European or settler ancestry arrived, making good and better lives day by day together with those they loved. What a thing to join. What a thing to be welcomed into, hey? It's great. Let's take a few moments to breathe together, and then we'll go exploring faith and doubt and all that good stuff. I think what we'll do this morning in terms of breathing is whatever you want. I'm going to use square breathing because at this point in my life, I don't think about the process so much with that rhythm, and it allows me to be still and be centered more quickly. And since this is a brief time, I value that. But if you want to just be still, if you think of prayer as something very different than this, and that you want a moment to pray, this might be a good moment for that. But as you choose. So let's be still together for a few moments. I'll let us know when we're done. All right. Let's pause together. Peace, everybody. I once heard a famous speaker describe what they were about to do as notes intensive. Just a little FYI. This might feel a bit notes intensive, a bit content intensive. And that's not arbitrary. And to the best of my ability, I'm working hard to have it also not be self-indulgent on my part. I have the enormous privilege of of addressing this community and talky bits week after week, a privilege that I hold very dear and do not take for granted. I do not regard it as promised, but I do cherish it, and I would hope for it to serve the community of the table, both near and far, as well as it can. And so I work with that in mind. But there's a fair bit of content here. And that's sort of a necessary establishment, it feels like, of some patterned or processed sort of ways of thinking about what we're exploring so that over the coming weeks we can unfold this more and have a frame of reference for that unfolding that allows us to sort of compare one part to another. More on that as we go. So I know that this might feel a bit more like work than we might feel queued up for on a Sunday morning, but I also feel confident that it's going to be worth the effort if we stick with it. We left off last week having just begun to consider what I called the stage that comes before the stages, in this particular model for how faith is formed and how it can change over time through the process of interacting with and being motivated, moved forward by doubt. And we're referring to that stage before the stages as stage zero. And it's the place we all start. And so it's an important kind of baseline. And we also talked about how it's a stage that can be compared to physical infancy. How it's all about me, me, me. And it's all about my needs and it's all about my feelings. And it's just all about stage zero. It's just all about me. And as a starting place, all about me is neither good nor bad. It's just what is. We might feel pretty familiar with stage zero as a stage of physical development. Many of us in this community have children. We've sort of been through this stage as parents where there were infants in the house. Most of the rest of us, if we haven't had that experience, we've been around little people and newborns. And so we're familiar with some of these ideas as they might be illustrated by a physical development stage. But what some of us might never have considered is that infancy or egocentrism is a stage of faith, a stage of belief. Stage zero is a view of the big questions. It's a view of life, and that is also the stage where we start to form our ideas about a whole collection of categories that give shape to faith. And that collection of categories in our work together here in the next while is going to form a sort of guiding grid for our examination of how faith and doubt evolve hand in hand, or how one of them is a catalyst for the movement of the other, at least. So to help us kind of get the grid into view, if you will, I'm going to just name all the categories that we're going to be working with going forward, because we'll work with each of them at each stage. And so I'm just going to name all the categories in a row, and then I'm going to go back through them in more detail. I think there's a few too many to remember, just at least, you know, running over them once. There's 18 altogether, it's quite a few. So I've posted a list of them to our Facebook page for reference. It's in this morning's post. So if it helps you to see them, if you're a visual learner, or to reference them sort of from a list as we go through them, then that list is right there on the page. So don't try to remember these. I'm just going to zoom through them. I'm just going to read the list, and then we're going to go back and break them down one by one. And that'll be the majority of our time together this morning, is kind of both learning that grid and plugging it into stage zero. All right. So these are the categories that we'll use to kind of guide our exploration of this topic: perception, focus, motive, key values, assumptions, authority figures, us, them, life is, dot, 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 identity, belonging, God is, dot, 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 core questions, mistakes are, dot, 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 strengths, weaknesses, good news, attitude toward doubt, and faith is, dot, dot, dot. Alrighty. Whew. Okay, so let's expand those a bit, and so they can stop being just a list of unassociated words, and they can start to be ideas that we can attach our own stories or our own experiences to. So we're just going to start from the top of the list, and we're going to work our way down from there. And just a quick note about process here. Working our way through the model this way is going to give us valuable information about the categories themselves, and it's also going to help us start to learn how to plug this information into understanding our own experiences of faith and doubt, and also the experiences of faith and doubt in the people around us. And I realized this when we were talking with our friends last night. We just sort of touched briefly on who are also a part of this community through the podcasts and through the Facebook page. They've never been to a physical gathering, but really thoughtful people. And as we were kind of talking about some of their life experiences and the experiences of people around them, I realized just how much this stuff plugs in to our life experiences. So I think it's going to be helpful. All right. So back to the list and working our way through it. In every stage that we'll work our way through, we have an overarching perception of how the world works. And our perception in this model is sort of like our guiding notion. It's sort of like the dominant lens through which we view everything. And in stage zero, that lens of perception might best be defined as narcissistic. The story of Narcissus, of course, among other things, is someone who's so self-absorbed with their own reflection that they eventually fall into the pond that they're looking at their face in and drown. Very self-absorbed. So to be narcissistic is to be extremely self-centered, to have an exaggerated sense of our own importance. In physical development, in that stage of egocentrism or infancy, that self-centeredness feels like it belongs, and we'll touch on that some more. But in physical development, if that self-centeredness becomes disordered, or it continues beyond that stage where it naturally occurs, then we become, if we're the person having that experience, we become increasingly unable to enter into the lives of others. And the same thing is true when it comes to this as a stage of faith. And we'll see how this perception of everything being about us bleeds into everything else as we go. So in each stage, we have an overarching perception. In each stage that we're going to consider, we have a primary focus, which is kind of like our central task. And in stage zero, our focus is survival and or comfort. It's not that hard to imagine how that fits with the perception that the world is all about us, right? Because if the world is all about me and I'm feeling comfortable, then the world is working the way that it should. And if I'm feeling uncomfortable, then the world isn't working the way that it should. That goes with the perception that it's all about me, right? In every stage, we will have some key values that are important to us. And in stage zero, our key values are things like surviving and staying safe and staying comfortable. And pretty much in that order, too. Once we've sort of settled the bottom of the pyramid, once we've sort of satisfactorily answered our questions about survival and safety, what's going to happen in stage zero is that we're going to be in hot pursuit of our own comfort. That's how we're going to operate. In each stage, we will have some assumptions that we make. And in stage zero, our main assumption is that we would be happy if others would just cooperate. Now, it's not rocket science to understand that this means that if we're feeling unhappy, it's never going to be our fault. It's just going to mean that somebody else isn't seeing things our way or doing things our way. So that's that assumption, is that the world is working as it ought to be working if I'm happy, and if I'm unhappy, it's not. Our authority figures in stage zero are our protectors, our caregivers, our providers. And this category of authority figures is a very important one as we go along. But in this stage, it sort of mostly just feels kind of obvious. If the world is all about me, then my authority figures are those who are, serving me. They're taking care of me. In each stage, we will have sort of a primary understanding or a dominant understanding of the us-them paradigm. And in stage zero, our primary understanding of us-them is built around those who please me versus those who don't. So if you make me happy, because this stage is all about me being happy, then you are for me. And if you don't make me happy, you are against me. Yep, it's a pretty crisp binary, and it can change in a moment, right? Because in one moment you might be making me happy, you're my best friend, and the next moment you make me unhappy, and this relationship is over, baby. Like, slam, and so it's a pretty crisp delineation in terms of us them. It occurred to me as I was preparing this that in many ways, up to this point in the process, in the grid, I'm outlining the personality and approach of the human beings behind some of the outpouring of polarization in our culture. Stage zero is sometimes just not very nuanced, you know? All right, let's move on from there though. If I'm completing in stage zero, if I'm completing the sentence life is, I would probably say life is either a family or life is a party. Life is those that take care of me taking care of me, or me with those that make me happy. That's the center of the story. Just a reminder that we're going to be using these same categories in each stage, and so by the end of the series, we're going to be able to see the evolution of these paradigms. We'll be able to sort of go, if in stage zero, life is was this, then stage one, life is can move to this, and in stage two, life is becomes this, and so on. We can kind of move across the grid as well as, down. Right now, we're just moving down the list, but we'll have a bit of a matrix to consider, which becomes an important idea in terms of living out of a more complex and nuanced understanding of what we're experiencing and going through in life. All right, so onto our list for a moment. My understanding of my identity at this stage is that my identity is undifferentiated and it's presumptive. Those terms kind of sound technical, but basically what that means is that my identity at this stage is that I don't think of myself as anything but complete. I am complete, and I don't stand back from that. I don't perceive myself as dependent, even, although someone looking from the outside might see that I'm dependent. Or incomplete in some profoundly important ways developmentally, but from inside of my experience, I don't see myself as dependent. It's just really all about me. Like I am everything in this stage. So that's what I mean by undifferentiated. I don't sort of separate myself from others. I'm not thinking about others at all. Why would I differentiate myself? It's all about me. So that's kind of my identity at stage zero. And that is consistent with my experience of belonging as well, which is that my mother or my parental figure at this stage is my whole universe. And that carries over into my understanding of God, in which God is undifferentiated from my parents or caregivers, and is pretty much in the same kind of functional category as like the Candyman or a magic genie. My core questions at this stage run along the lines of, am I safe and comfortable? Do I like this? Does this make me feel good or bad? me, 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 right? That's stage zero. My understanding of mistakes, and this is quite intriguing to me, my understanding of mistakes in stage zero is that mistakes are equal to punishable behaviors. And to say that without having the other stage definitions to compare it to weakens its emphasis quite a bit. So we'll kind of maybe come back to it with some comparative things later. But basically what that means is that in stage zero, if I don't get punished for something, then that's okay. It's okay to do. If I get punished for it, then it's a mistake. This is interesting because this feels like an intriguing lens through which to consider things like, let's say, like apologies, public or otherwise. Is the person apologizing authentically sorry for their choice or action? Can they take responsibility for it? Or are they just sorry that they got caught? Are they just regarding it as a mistake because they got their hands slapped for it? If we're measuring right and wrong based on whether we're being punished or rewarded, this does not take a lot of reflection, but we might miss it if we don't stop. If we're measuring right and wrong based on whether we're being punished or rewarded, we can easily fool ourselves into believing something is right as long as A, we don't get caught and punished, or B, we're surrounded by voices that reward what we're doing and protect us from being caught, and that keep reinforcing that this is right, this is good. They keep rewarding us because it's all about us, right? Now, if by this point you're starting to form a picture of a very immature person in your imagination, remember that in terms of human development, we expect these characteristics in a newborn or an infant. They are appropriate to stage zero. However, we do not expect them to continue beyond that stage. That's part of what makes stage zero interesting in a bigger grid of how faith evolves and how it interacts with doubt. We can probably all see glimpses of ourselves in some of these things that we've already talked about, or at least in certain moments or under some circumstances. And generally speaking, we don't think of those moments as our best ones. And that's partly because we're not looking at them from a stage zero vantage point. Also a very important part of this whole idea. So we might be forgiven at this point in the process for thinking that there's nothing desirable about stage zero except growing out of it. But there are some strengths to stage zero as well. And in stage zero, my strengths might be things like being emotionally transparent, being aware of my needs and desires, being uninhibited, being spontaneous, you know, all that stuff that we sometimes lament having lost as we've grown up, or things that have been trained out of us. Why can't I play anymore without being self-conscious? Well, because you've become self-conscious. You've become conscious of yourself. These are things that we find ourselves in the therapist's office going, I can't feel. I can't get in touch with my needs and my desires. As soon as I do, I experience guilt, or I disassociate, or whatever happens, depending on the severity and the story and all of that. And we're like, I need to recover some. Or we're trying to recover. One way to understand it is sometimes some of the strengths of stage zero. So that ability to just kind of go straight to the way things are inside of us, that's one of the strengths of stage zero. We'll see something similar to this in other stages as well, in the sense that we don't just move on and leave everything from a previous stage behind. Sometimes we need things from other stages, or we find ourselves cycling back into them for a variety of reasons, not all of which are necessarily some kind of negative regression. Sometimes they're about a recovery of something good from that stage, or it's necessity at a certain, in the midst of a certain experience we're having, whatever stage we're in. So again, that'll, I think, all make a little more sense, and it will certainly gain some nuance as we add other stage information to the model, all right? So this is, by the way, part of what I was referring to when I said earlier, last week before, that this isn't a model that's just linear and sequential. It's not just good, better, best, which also means that it's not about us kind of trying to get to stage four so we can park out in stage four and just vertically judge all those poor folks who are slogging it out in some less evolved, inferior stage. It's more complex than that. And we can tell that it's more complex than that sort of just by being honest with ourselves about our own life experiences and things we go through and how sometimes we're like, yeah, you know what? I need to get in touch with that child thing. So just as an example, sometimes we want or need to be childlike, but we do tend to differentiate between childlike and childish, and childlike tends to be more helpful as we go than childish. And since this whole exploration that we're in here is about the relationship between faith and doubt, this might be a good moment to pause and reflect a bit on one of those, I would say, often misapplied teaching of Jesus moments. I just feel like I've seen this story get misunderstood and plugged in really harmful ways in religious settings far too often. I'm going to illustrate this from the teachings of Jesus because those are the ones I know the best, but the pattern of how an idea like the one that this story explores, and this is often true, I think, of the teachings of spiritual leaders, gurus, rabbis, thought leaders, you know, people who kind of seem to have tapped a deeper vein in their understanding and storytelling. I'm going to illustrate it from a Jesus story, partly because of the makeup of our community, partly because of my own journey and exposure to those stories and having spent a lot of time working with them and thinking about them. But this is an idea that can be abused or used to control people across the board. And so I think it's worth keeping an eye out for it wherever it might occur. But I'll illustrate it from those stories. One of the ways we can tell that certain stories that Jesus told or experiences people had with Jesus stories had a lot of traction in the early going when folks were writing this stuff down is who bothered to write down which stories and how many people bothered to write them down. This is a story that shows up in the Gospels, the stories, Jesus stories of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which is a bit of a rare thing. It doesn't occur in John. John was written quite a bit later and reflects much more the understandings that people are already beginning to form on their own around their experiences with the teachings of Jesus. So sort of early going of Christianity, if you will. But in these first stories, the stories written closer to when people kind of walked around with this rabbi and heard them tell their stories, this one shows up in three of the four. So people notice this story. And it's a story where Jesus gets pretty unhappy with those that he's teaching. Maybe that's why people remembered it. We don't have a lot of those stories. He gets pretty unhappy with those that he's teaching because in the story, they pull rank as adults and they try to head off some other adults that are trying to bring their little people to be blessed by the rabbi. And they're just like, nope, rabbi's busy. He's dealing with the big people. Get the rugrats out of here, you know? And Jesus just lands on them. It's an interesting story on several levels, not the least of which is how much emotion the gospel writers attribute to Jesus in the story. Again, something that doesn't happen that often in the stories. In some ways, this is why we get this sort of floaty images of Jesus in our imagination of him just kind of cruising through crisis and laying out the lesson, you know? There's obvious, you know, exceptional moments to this, you know, turning over tables comes to mind. The song we sometimes sing, right? But not a lot. And Mark, especially as among those writers, writes about Jesus' emotions more than the others do. And notes in this story that Jesus is really, he's really, really displeased with his followers in this moment. If we were going to translate the language Jesus uses in Mark's story literally, Jesus tells his followers to, and the word that he uses when he tells them to switch directions is he says to stop preventing the children from having access to him and to start allowing it. In other words, do an about face from what you're doing. Right now you're preventing it and not allowing it. You need to stop preventing it and start allowing it. So just utterly switch gears here, folks. This is a story that often gets used to make the point that we need to have faith like a child to get into heaven. Oh man, this is such a great example of how we kind of can't help but read our experience or read the things in front of us through the lens of our experience and what we've been taught, which is partly why doubt becomes so important, because it's a way of examining those things more carefully and independently. The reading that the story where Jesus says, you know, don't stop the children from coming to me, stop stopping them and let them come to me. The reading that this is a story about the kind of faith we should have and that we should have faith like a child in order to get into heaven is a pretty significant miss, actually, on what's going on in the story. And there's a couple of reasons for that. The first is that, with the exception of Matthew, Jesus doesn't use the language of heaven at all. in these stories in translation. And in the original, it's even sort of further away from that. He uses the language of the kingdom of God, and in Matthew, he uses the language of the kingdom of heaven. It's not an address for Jesus. And so in the teachings of Jesus, the kingdom of God is anywhere that God is present, anywhere that the divine is present. That's the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, right? And for Jesus as a Jew and as a Jewish rabbi, God, because of all the tribal competition historically for the Jews about whose God comes out on top of the stack, God's not a being in the Jewish understanding that shares space. God is a preeminent being who fully occupies the space. So in other words, God is in all for a rabbi like Jesus. But being aware of or connecting to that ever-present and everywhere present reality isn't a given. It's a choice. And it takes faith in Jesus' understanding and the way he teaches it. It takes faith to experience that connection. Now, here's where this tends to go sideways. When Jesus tells people that they need to have faith like a child in order to experience the presence of God, or of love, which is how Jesus defined God, God is love, is sort of his most succinct statement about the nature of the divine. When Jesus says that we need to have faith like a child in order to experience the presence of love, he didn't mean regressing into every aspect of stage zero and living there. He meant starting there. That's why he uses the language of enter into the kingdom of heaven, not live there, enter there. He meant starting there. He meant starting in the place where whoever is showing us love and kindness and taking care of us is basically our experiential equivalent of God. They are our way of encountering the divine. And so that's why the language that's used in the stories talks about entering the kingdom of heaven this way. Entering at stage zero. It's a starting point. But it is not an appropriate state of being for the whole journey. Listen, if gateway drug can ever be a good metaphor, then stage zero is sort of like the gateway drug to a thing that kind of human experiences we might use a word like faith for. It's basically like an entry point to experiencing goodness and love as a life-suffusing, confidence-building, everywhere, everything reality. If my mother loves me as a self-absorbed infant, my world is filled with love because my world is all about me and my experience. If God is love and my mother loves me, my world is filled with God. I hope that made sense. So far, so good, let's just say. Not so good if, as my circle of authority figures expands outward beyond that primary caregiver or nurturer or mom or whomever that is, as my circle of authority figures expands outwards, and we'll see that in these subsequent stages, if those authority figures keep telling me to trust them like a child, as though they were still the center of my universe and the embodiment of God in my lived experience, I am now in danger of not developing the way that I should. I am now in danger of being kept in stage zero by my authority figures. And again, we'll unpack this more as we go. But we can sort of see how stage zero as an entry point is quite beautiful, quite appropriate, needed, and not the state in which we should stay as things move along. We'll consider this more from some other vantage points as we move through the stages, but I wanted to address it at least a little bit at this stage, especially since stories like that one are so often applied in ways that keep people from evolving their faith, that hold them down, that repress them developmentally. As people of faith and people of doubt. And that's really not the point of the story. The point of the story is you're stopping someone from entering something. Stop it. This is an appropriate entry point. But that's what it is. It's an entry point. Unless you have faith like a child, you can't enter this. But don't live there forever. All right. It was considering some possible strengths of stage zero that sort of got us off on that topic to begin with. So by way of kind of keeping this with some nuance and some balance, let's briefly consider some weaknesses of this stage. this is sort of a review already, but the obvious weakness is that at stage zero, I am largely oblivious to the needs and desires of others. On the other side of the coin again, some good news in this stage is the possibility that in a good version of the story, I am loved and I am safe and I experience those things. This next category is a very important one in our model, but in stage zero, it gets pretty short shrift because it sort of feels like it recovers some things. In stage zero, my attitude toward doubt in stage zero is that it's inconceivable. I can't say it's inconceivable without hearing the Princess Bride in my head. It's inconceivable. In stage zero, doubt is just not on the radar at all. I do not have the ability in stage zero to stand outside of myself and what I'm being taught enough to even doubt it. So it just not there. And this might be a little bit hard for some of us to imagine given our personal experiences. One of the challenges with a concept like stage zero in the first place is that we're trying to describe experiences we had before we were standing back and looking at our own experiences and trying to consider what they meant. So we're reflecting on the least self-conscious stage of our development. Tricky. It's a stage in which we are self-absorbed, yes, but self-conscious, no. So anyway, which is why when we come to the final category, which is faith is, it sort of makes sense that in stage zero, faith has two likely shapes. And the first shape that faith is likely to take in stage zero is that it's basically equivalent to trust in my caregivers. Since the world in stage zero is all about me, if those that are taking care of me are loving and good, God, or however I name the divine when I'm looking back at this stage, is loving and good. If I am loved by those who are taking care of me, and my being taken care of and being made happy is the center of my universe, then that's great. My faith is intact, if you will. If I continue in this stage of faith beyond those earliest formative experiences, then what happens is a shift. If I continue in stage zero beyond that super dependent stage, what happens is that my faith starts to get placed in my own ability to get what I need by any means necessary, because it's still all about me. If there's something about that idea that kind of makes something in you go ping, kind of gets on your radar, it might be the same thing that gives us pause when we encounter people that say you can't trust anyone but yourself. Or even that when we encounter someone who says that we should engage anyone other than ourselves, with our first position of engagement being distrust. That perspective, that we can only trust ourselves and that we should begin with distrust in others when we engage with them, is, among other things, the stunted perspective on faith that is one of the main underpinnings of runaway individualism. The message that the only being we can trust is ourselves and that we are the center. If you ever kind of want an obvious, easy-to-access story version of this, watch or read a Western, you know, like a cowboy Western. This is the narrative that's running in the not-so-background of the narrative shape, that's like the lone gunslinger who rides into town, solves the problems with their own brand of justified violence and their six-shooter, and then rides off into the sunset alone. Stories like that, stories with that shape, and there's some really good scholarship on this that's quite fascinating. Stories like that are foundational to, among other things, toxic masculinity, which, when you gather toxic masculinity up and you mix it together with some societal power, including religious power, you get ideas like the doctrine of discovery. You get movements in history like the era of colonization. It's all about me and what I believe. I don't need anything but me and what I believe. Me and what I believe are right, to the exclusion of all other considerations. And if some part of what I believe is, I understand, is a thing that everybody else needs, sort of gross, then I'm going to take that understanding and I'm going to visit it on others with whatever power I have. Tim Penner, who you know lives in the world of film, just popped a comment up on my screen that says, "Also, see all superhero movies." Yep. It's a fascinating study in itself to consider these sorts of narratives, you know, the gunslinger narratives or the superhero narratives, through the lens of how every one of those stories, in some way or shape or other, is sort of a very traditional, but quite immature Christian story. Anyway, not what we're exploring today, but you can write a thesis on that one. Well, somebody's already written that thesis, probably several someone's, but maybe you can find something new to do your studies on that's out of that. But it's a really interesting realm of study. These are not little ideas. Like this stuff we've been exploring through this grid, when you put it into a grid like that, that can feel sort of really compact and kind of like, here's a little statement about this. And of course, they can be that. They can stay there. But if we stand back from this stuff and we start to look at the world a little bit through some of these lenses, we realize there are far too many people in far too many places of power that have not left stage zero, perhaps, or that for whom there are profoundly significant aspects of stage zero that are deeply lodged and not easily dislodged. And they're surrounded by sycophants. They're surrounded by people who cater to that and support that because it serves them well. It makes them happy. It feeds them what they want to eat. These are not small matters. They have impact. I would say that it might be possible to live out of such an understanding of faith, a stage zero understanding of faith, but I would also say that to live from such an understanding means that really you end up profoundly lonely, profoundly isolated, and radically separated from the good, life-altering, albeit sometimes very challenging experiences of loving and being loved, or surrounding yourself alternatively with only those that serve the perspective you have. Lots of folks are observing these days because of social media, social polarization, so on and so forth, that it's increasingly possible to surround ourselves only with those that share our point of view about things, only to hear messages that reinforce the one that we prefer to have reinforced. In a grid like this, that's another way of saying it's increasingly possible to live a life in which many factors conspire or collaborate to keep us developmentally stunted, to keep us lodged in stage one and not growing beyond it in how we see the world and understand things and believe things and have what we might call an experience of faith and, of course, an experience of doubt. Because doubt's a thing you can't let into stage one. It's just, as we said, it's just not on the radar. As soon as you let doubt into stage one, or stage zero rather, you move into stage one. And we'll explore that next week. We'll see how stage one is super important, not least of all because it's what gets us out of stage zero, which is not a place we're made to stay. To kind of try to bring this together into something that's a little easier to carry away maybe, because like I said, that was a bit content intensive. Childlike is not the same thing as childish. Childlike faith is not the same thing as childish faith. Starting out egocentristic and narcissistic in a world that is all about me and my experiences is developmentally needful, appropriate, how it seems to be structured, how we're made. Staying there, not good. We need to move, and it's doubt that moves us. We'll see that when we kind of get into this more next week. If we never have doubt, we never examine the stage that we're in. That's what doubt is. It's the examination of that. If we never have doubt and we never examine the stage that we're in, we don't leave it. And as we see as we'll go along, being discouraged from doubting is also a way of being encouraged to not leave the stage we're in, which then immediately raises the question, who is best served by such a thing? Things to explore. All right, we're going to get into that more next week. I think that's probably plenty for now. just a reminder that that we this is not the only way we gather. If you're part of this community in an ongoing way, you're probably aware of the thing called End Lunch After, which is a Zoom hang that happens every Sunday at 12:30. It'll happen this Sunday at 12:30. And then we also have a midweek version of that Wednesday evenings at 7:30. That's the Wednesday evening hang. Those happen on Zoom. If you want to connect with those gatherings and you're listening to the podcast and some subsequent week, the links for them can be found on our website and also on our Facebook page. And of course, if you're on the email list, they're in the post every week. Unless the person writing the post forgets to put them in there, which sometimes happens. Who would that be? All right. Peace, everybody. Thanks for listening. Thanks for thinking. Thanks for contributing. And being such a thoughtful community with which to journey. We're fortunate people to be able to travel together. I'm grateful.